welcome to We the People Radio on Easter Sunday. Today is April the 12th. We're all having April the 12th, 2020, I should point out.
There you go.
We're all having Easter inside.
Yeah.
Or outside, far away from other people.
Yeah.
So go down in history.
6 foot minimum.
The weirdest Easter ever. Yeah. Who's our sponsor this hour? Mr. Bill?
Oh. Well, my name's Bill Cundiff, and our sponsor...
Oh, that's why I called you Mr. Bill.
Yeah. Who are you? I forgot. Our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere ag and turf dealer. Pape Machinery handles John Deere, Honda, steel. If you got to have it in your yard or small farm, they got it down there. So go down and see them. They're at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in Shasta Lake City. Or give them a call at 226-9226, or you can get them on the web.
There's more?
Oh, yeah. They actually have a web address
of
papemachinery.com. Yeah, so give them a holler.
So handy. I think even people who have never done anything on the internet are doing it now, because that's your gateway to the world these days.
That's right. Nobody gets a phone book anymore.
And gas hasn't been this cheap in a long time. Isn't that just cruel?
Yeah, I heard somewhere in the country you can get it for 79 cents a gallon now.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know where. God. I think you got to drive about 400 miles to get that. But
it's totally worth it.
Oh, yeah.
Totally worth it. Hey, and we also wanted to let you know that this program, although it is a radio program, it's also airing on Channel 23.7 on KRDT Tuesday nights in Reading as part of the American Uncensored Network. Every time I see AUN, I just forget what it means. But American Uncensored Network, which makes a lot of... It makes sense for us. It's a good spot for us.
That's the only place we can be is the Uncensored Network.
We've always said we have faces for radio. Now, well, that's blown.
Well, I blew that.
We're hiding behind these big puffy microphones, so it's probably pretty good. So our guest today, I just want to let you know, in case I forget to say something about it, but I have listed all his books on the website for today, and I'm going to move those to the other pages where we have had him on, because he has got some cool books out there. His name is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. He's the Executive Director of the Task Force on National Homeland Security and the Director of the U.S. Nuclear Strategy Forum. Both are congressional advisory boards. He served on the Congressional EMP Commission, the Congressional Strategic Posture Commission, and the House Armed Services Committee, along with, just for good measure, the CIA. He has a PhD in history and archaeology and another one in strategic studies, which led him to the CIA. So look out there. If you're thinking about getting a PhD in strategic studies, you're going to wind up at the CIA. Spoiler alert. He's the author of a whole bunch of cool books, but his most recent one is The Power and the Light. And I'm not going to wreck it by giving you the little synopsis, because he would be much better at that since he wrote it. So Dr. Pry, thanks for hanging out with us this afternoon on indoor Easter day.
Always a pleasure to be on your show. You are so well informed and also have such a good sense of humor about these things.
Well, because they're also dire.
Enjoy our interviews.
Yeah, they're always so dire. If we don't goof around a little bit, it's just like life sucks and then you die. Yeah. We might as well just say that and sign off.
Yeah, and your hair catches on fire too.
Oh, there's that.
Yeah,
we don't want to be adding to that madness. So, you want to give people a little blurb about your book so that we don't, you know, get lost. That doesn't get lost in the shuffle.
Sure. Have a habit of forgetting to mention it, but I think it's probably the most important book I've written. It's called The Power and the Light, the Congressional EMP Commission's War to Save America. And basically what it does is it doesn't just describe the existential threat to our civilization from electromagnetic pulse, which can be caused by nature and by man, by nuclear and non-nuclear weapons, or by a solar superstorm, which is inevitable. We're going to get hit with one someday for sure. In fact, certainly no later than the next generation, since the likelihood of a geomagnetic superstorm is 12% per decade. The book describes those threats, but goes beyond that. It describes, most importantly, the ongoing struggle within the U.S. government to protect our society, or not to protect our society, against this EMP threat. Back last March, on the 26th of March, it's almost a little over 1 year ago, in 2019, President Trump signed an executive order heeding the advice of scientists and strategists that for 20 years have been seeking an executive order from the president to protect our society on an emergency basis from EMP. And well, President Trump did it. And
what was the holdup on that?
Pardon me?
I mean, why did it take so long?
Well, that's a good question. I've written a whole book about it. And the short answer is, if I'm capable of giving a short answer to anything, there's a number of answers to that. You know, part of it was that the EMP threat, the existential nature of the EMP threat, was deeply classified. You know, we discovered it, and the Department of Defense knew about it. The intelligence community knew about it since 1963. But it wasn't declassified, so the policymakers and the general public could understand the gory details about it until the EMP Commission reports were published in 2008. And even then, they didn't receive wide circulation. It was among policymakers, and it's taken many years to really educate the public. And even today, especially the liberal press, you know, still can't get its mind around it. A lot of people still can't get their mind around it. But that was part of it. A lot of presidents just didn't even know about it. And policymakers didn't know about it. Didn't know that there were simple and expensive means of protecting the society. And then we've encountered enormous resistance from the electric utilities, chiefly, who have very powerful lobbies, and they fund entire fake science think tanks like the Electric Power Research Institute to produce junk science studies. They've been putting out studies even now trying to argue that the EMP threat isn't real or it isn't as severe as the EMP Commission says, and they should have no more credibility than the kinds of so-called independent laboratory research that was funded by the cigarette companies back in the 50s to prove there was no causal linkage.
Nothing to see here. Move along.
Cancer. But yeah. That kind of bureaucratic lobbying resistance, and these guys have, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars a year they spend. They donate heavily to practically own key members of Congress who run the energy committees. And so it took a president who had some great courage and had anti-establishment views and was willing to entire eight departments and agencies of the U.S. government, by the way, are captured by these. I mean, the Department of Energy practically belongs to the electric utilities. You know, there's a rotating door between these departments and agencies that are supposed to regulate things like the electric power industry and the oil and fuel industries and the like, and the people who are in the departments and agencies. So, you know, the fight is still going on between you know, people like myself and you know, the scientists and strategists who belong to the EMP Commission, and those within the White House and the administration who support our views, who are few in number, and the much more numerous and well-positioned permanent bureaucracy that we know is the deep state. You know, almost all of the people who are supposed to implement President Trump's EMP executive order, by the way, are holdovers from the Obama administration who spent 8 years fighting against us, doing nothing about the EMP threat. And they want to continue to do nothing. And so that's where we are. And that's what the book is about. It explains, you know, where we've come, what the EMP threat is, why the country hasn't been protected, you know, for decades. The effort by President Trump and the EMP Commission to get us protected, and we have, despite this David versus Goliath conflict, you know, I mean, on the one side, as I said, you have a handful of scientists and strategists who have the facts and are the truth about the EMP threat. On the other hand, these vested bureaucratic interests, including just a lot of stupid people who don't understand the EMP threat, but typical Washington bureaucrats, they want to continue business as usual and don't want to change the way they do business to accommodate. And this would require them to seriously change the way they do business in terms of protecting the country. And they would rather not get off their laurels and do the work.
So do you think maybe has the virus helped at all? I mean, because
I think
we weren't going to have that either.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm hoping it will. I hope it would accomplish two things. The one and most obvious thing I think it is accomplishing, which is giving people a quick education on how fragile our society is, how little it takes to bring our economy crashing down, and to disrupt people's lives and disrupt the supplies of the necessaries of life. This is the coronavirus is not a true existential threat. It's just chiefly a psychological threat.
It was enough entire country of toilet paper in less than 24 hours, though.
Right. I never bought in to the CDC and NIH predictions that this was going to kill 2 million people. I've been saying all along, and I've written articles to the effect that they were overreacting to this. And I think the numbers are going to prove that out. In the end, I think the deaths from the collateral consequences of putting 16 million people out of work are going to be far worse than anything the coronavirus does. I think I predict that the deaths from increased deaths from suicide and drug addiction and the despair, the breakup of families, and the spike in violence, the increase in murders that always accompanies an economic downturn, is going to kill a lot more Americans than the coronavirus did. So that's one thing. So lesson number one from the coronavirus is how fragile we are as a society. What happens if we get hit with a real existential threat like EMP that will destroy the critical infrastructures, which are all driven by electricity, one way or another, and that shuts our society down, really, not on a voluntary basis, but really shuts it down.
Well,
so cars don't work, transportation, communications don't work, the food supply, we only have a 30-day food supply to feel, and it will begin to spoil as soon as the electricity goes off. We can't feed 330 million Americans for more than 30 days under good circumstances, but when the electricity is off, that food supply will start perish.
Well, all bets are off when the lights go off
immediately. Now, that's why we would lose in an EMP event, whether it's from the sun or from a nuclear weapon or from a non-nuclear weapon, why we would lose 90% of Americans in 1 year. So that's lesson number one.
We've got to take one quick break here. I sort of blew it. I was supposed to do it 3 minutes ago. So we better do that so that we can celebrate capitalism here for a couple of minutes. And we will be right back with our guest, Dr. Peter Vincent Bry.
What shall we do about them? When they move into your neighborhood, they take over, but good. Body and soul, then it's just your body, then they go. What shall we do about them?
Okay, so we took our break. I guess we disconnected you too. So you had a full break there. So go on the things with the EMP that we're not paying attention to at this point.
Yeah, you had asked me about the coronavirus and whether this might be a wake up call for people, and I had explained that in one respect, I hope there were two ways in which I hoped it was a wake up call, and in one way I was sure that it was demonstrating that people were learning how fragile our society is, and I was hoping that it was opening their imaginations, not just the people, but more importantly the policymakers, so that they would realize that we are really vulnerable and fragile as a society, and we can't afford to get hit by a real existential threat like EMP. So maybe we'd better start protecting our electric grids and other critical infrastructure. So that's one thing I'm hoping might come out of this, and that the government might get out of the way and start taking more seriously President Trump's EMP executive order and actually implementing it. But the second thing I think we probably aren't learning, but the second lesson I'm learning from this, because it has been sort of an eye-opener for me too, is I always have known, I mean, I'm a creature of Washington myself. I've spent my whole professional life working in the intelligence and defense area in Washington, and I've always known that that Washington is broken and that it's incompetent and corrupt. All right? So
that's the upside.
Other than that, it's okay.
The scale and the depth of the incompetence and corruption, the coronavirus is a real wake-up call for me here on this. And it kind of takes away the hope that I had in lesson number one, you know, because we have seen, you know, this move that we are living through this business with the coronavirus. You know, we have spent decades. I mean, biological, unlike EMP, biological warfare is no secret. I mean, we've known about the possibility of biological warfare since the 60s and taken it seriously, or supposed to have taken it seriously as an existential threat since the 60s. We've spent decades and billions of dollars getting ready, or we were supposed to have, getting ready for biological warfare. I mean, that's why the NIH and the Center for Disease Control exist. That was the original motive for establishing them. We even have a Deputy Secretary of Defense, you know, very high-ranking official in the Pentagon, a Deputy Secretary. I mean, that's number two to the Secretary of Defense, all right? And he is whose job it is to protect and defend against nuclear, chemical, and biological threats. We have biological weapons laboratories that are supposed to be researching defenses against the worst kind of pathogens that the enemy can create. Now, we don't have offensive biological weapon programs anymore, not the United States, because we signed the Biological and Chemical Weapons Convention decades ago, and so we don't have stockpiles of offensive biological pathogens for making war, although we do have such pathogens for purposes of defense so that we can research antitoxins and pharmaceuticals that would protect us from them. And we're supposed to be doing that. We're supposed to be doing that. And yet, something like the coronavirus, you know, which is not a serious biological weapon. I mean, in the end, you know, I was predicting that this thing is going to be not much worse than the flu in terms of the absolute numbers of more people killed. And I think the numbers are starting to bear that out. A real biological weapon, like genetically engineered anthrax or genetically engineered smallpox, has a 90% mortality rate or higher, 90% or higher. You know, not the 1% to 2% they're talking about, and I'll bet it'll be even lower than that, the mortality rate for coronavirus. And yet our government, after decades and billions spent supposedly getting ready for, in worst case, biological warfare scenarios, isn't even capable of handling the coronavirus, even in the simplest, most basic ways. An intelligent high school student charged with protecting our country would have known to have masks stockpiled, you know, surgical gowns, pharmaceuticals available, basic stuff, you know, and we didn't have it. It has taken the intervention of the President of the United States to step into the chaos and make up for an unprepared bureaucracy. Although, and I am a fan of President Trump, and I'm sure this will make people unhappy because nobody likes even a pro-Trump person to criticize the president, but I am bewildered that he has put in charge of the coronavirus strategy the very people who caused the problem. The people that we're seeing on television, Dr. Fauci and, oh, I can't remember the woman's name, all right, that we see every night. These people are part of the deep state. You know, they're the ones who failed to prepare the country. You know, a good businessman should know better than to than to take the people who caused the problem and then give them the money and the power to solve the problem. Furthermore, there seems to be a kind of a naive assumption in the White House that the NIH and the CDC are staffed by objective scientists who don't have political or ideological agendas, and that is not the case. You know, the CDC and NIH are very political. You know, they're the ones that are spending taxpayer money on reports about that attack the Second Amendment. You know, how that treat gun violence as a form of disease, and they also support the gay liberation agenda. Now, I'm not saying that all of these people deliberately set President Trump up, but I am certainly questioning their competence, and I also think that they won't be sad to see President Trump fail to get reelected. It can't be coincidence where the liberal mainstream media is concerned. You know, that their desire to fan a hysteria over the coronavirus seems to have begun when they found that fear of the coronavirus started driving the economy into the ditch, you know, because the stock market, you know, crashed. And now, because of these policies of shutting the whole country down, which we've never done before for any, not even during the Spanish influenza.
And yeah, not even for diseases that were worse than the coronavirus.
Spanish influenza was far worse than the coronavirus. It was one of the worst pandemics in human history, and that came out of Mother Nature's laboratory. It wasn't a genetically engineered biological weapon, which would be far worse, but it's Spanish influenza. You know, it killed something like 25% of the global, or 25% of the global population was infected, and a substantial fraction, maybe 10% or so, died. You know, something like 50 million people. More people than were killed in World War I were killed in 18 months by the Spanish influenza. And we didn't shut the whole country down, or we had the power to do that. You know, President Wilson could have done that. You know, he had exercised enormous centralized state powers to the federal government to run World War I. You know, there was including censorship of the media, something that we would consider unthinkable today. But there were extraordinary powers exercised by the federal government to fight World War I that were not exercised during the Spanish influenza. And we got through that. So that's my lesson number two. Hold that thought.
Basically, before we move forward,
because they are very incompetent and corrupt, and that makes me concerned about whether the president's EMP executive order will, in the end, be implemented effectively. It's not enough to just have the president order it. You know, it has to be implemented effectively by the deep state, and that's what my book is about. It's about the power and the light. It's about the struggle between basically the scientists and the real EMP experts on the one hand, and the incompetent bureaucrats on the other. The struggle that's going on right now, and I named the names. There's about 10 people actually in the deep state that are Obama holdovers that are responsible for sabotaging this executive order upon which the future of our civilization depends.
Ooh, you know, and on that note, hold on, let's give him a cliffhanger. On the backside of the commercial, you give us the list?
They'll have to read the book to get that.
Nice. Good answer. Good. All right, we'll be right back with our guest, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. And if you would like to find the book swiftly, go to wethepeopleradio.us. It's right on there.
When the lights go down in the city,
Yeah, the last place you want to be if the lights go out is in the city by the bay, a.k.a. San Francisco.
Yeah.
Yeah, not a good idea.
No, you're probably going to step in something nasty.
Okay, so we left you on this cliffhanger that you're not getting an answer to, so I guess it's an over-the-cliff deal. But I really do hope the people run out and get your book, The Power and the Light, and they'll find out. Is it just 10 people in particular, or do you kind of...
There are 10 people in particular.
Okay.
And in fact, there's one position called the EMP czar. I call it the EMP czar. I mean, that's for inside the Beltway. Refer to this person as the EMP czar who works for the Department of Homeland Security. If the president even changes that person, that one person, it could make all the difference. And as long as we're on this topic, I'd also like to mention, your audience isn't helpless. I hope they step up and become EMP warriors and help me and the EMP task force with our fight in Washington. They can do that by getting the book and educating themselves, and then harassing their senators and congressmen, and writing to President Trump, thanking him for the EMP executive order, but urging him, you know, to get rid of these people, and then. On my EMP Task Force website, www.emptaskforce.us, there is a petition. There is a petition that I would ask people to sign, you know, and this petition is going to go to the White House, www.emptaskforce.us, www.emptaskforce.us. And, you know, the president has so many things to cope with currently, including the coronavirus, but when he comes out of the coronavirus, there's going to be many things that are going to be on his desk. And if we can get enough people to sign a petition, if I can get 100,000 signatures on this petition, there's sort of a White House rule that the president will see it. So that's one way where you can directly help, and go to that website, www.emptaskforce.us, and sign the petition, please.
What
adding that to our site too.
When was the last big solar EMP we had in this country, Dr. Pryor? And what would happen if we had one today of that same magnitude?
Well, there was a big solar storm in 1989 called the Hydro-Quebec storm. It wasn't a super storm, but it was a big storm, and it blocked out half of Canada in about 90 seconds, and it melted the coils of an extra high voltage transformer at a nuclear power plant, a U.S. nuclear power plant in New Jersey, the Salem nuclear power plant. That transformer was designed to carry 750,000 volts, which is an enormous amount of energy, and yet it was melted in 90 seconds. So, and that was not a solar superstorm. That was a big storm, but not a superstorm. And if that storm were to hit the United States, if it were to be focused on the United States instead of Canada, it alone would have catastrophic consequences that could potentially kill a lot of people. The storms we really worry about are the superstorms, and there was one in 1921 called the Railroad Storm, and that. Hit North America, covered all of North America. It's called the Railroad Storm because it destroyed the electronics throughout the U.S. railroad system, so that the railroad switches didn't work, radio stations were blacked out, the electronics that ran railroad control systems were burned. In New York City, the building actually burned down, and another railroad building for electronics burned down in Massachusetts, and nations in Europe, communications were affected in Europe, but we weren't an electronic civilization.
Right. We're much more high tech now. So
you know, yeah, we are much more high tech now, and we didn't live off the electric grid the way we do now. So, and if something like that were to happen today, that could kill millions of people. So something like the 1921 railroad, the most powerful solar storm on record, was in 1859. That was the Carrington event, and that was a worldwide event. You know, the 1921 railroad storm chiefly was the locus was on North America, the 1859 event affected the whole world and destroyed telegraph systems all over the world. And again, burned down telegraph stations and caused forest fires and destroyed the transatlantic cable. But fortunately, you know, electrical systems were in their infancy. Those were the horse and buggy days. We didn't live off of electricity, and so it didn't end civilization. But if that happened today, or if the 1921 railroad storm hit us again today, that would basically doom us. The whole world would be doomed in the case of the Carrington event. North America would be doomed in the case of the 1921 railroad storm. And yet we know how to protect against this. It doesn't cost that much to do it. You know, the other threats, of course, are something, a nuclear EMP attack, you know, which could be executed by North Korea or China or Russia and probably Iran. And then there are non-nuclear EMP weapons that have gotten more powerful and more sophisticated. We have some ourselves. The U.S. Air Force last year got a new cruise missile called the Chant, which is designed to use a non-nuclear EMP warhead to fry electronics. It has a much more limited field than the nuclear weapon. You know, the field is a few kilometers to either side of the cruise missile. But the thing is, the cruise missile can just cruise around endlessly over a territory and fry. Eventually, it fries all the electronics. So, and of course, you don't need something as sophisticated as a cruise missile. You know, a group of terrorists, you know, 12 of them armed with hand-carried non-nuclear EMP devices could run around and destroy enough transformer substations so they could put the whole country into dark that way. So this is a threat we need to deal with, and if you're protected against the worst of these threats, a nuclear EMP attack, it'll also protect you against the lesser threats, non-nuclear EMP, solar EMP, which is while it has something like the Carrington event can cover the whole world, the field strengths aren't as high as you get from a nuclear weapon. So if you're protected against the nuclear, it also protects you against the solar EMP. And cyber attacks and physical sabotage also would be mitigated, because the chief way those means of taking down the grid do it is by attacking the same vulnerable nodes and causing system-generated overvoltages. They don't add any electricity to the grid the way an EMP does, but they cause overvoltages, which result in cascading failures. To give you an example, if you were to take out a couple of transformers, the load has to go somewhere, all right? So it goes on to the next nearest transformers, and they're not designed to carry that much load. If you're destroying big transformers that carry, you know, 500,000 volts, so suddenly you're forcing the system to dump 500,000 volts from its own, that the system itself has generated, onto neighboring transformers, and they get destroyed, and then the voltage they were carrying has to go somewhere. So you can see how it becomes a quickly cascading failure,
right,
that would ripple through the whole grid eventually, bringing the whole thing down. And if you're protected against the nuclear EMP attack, it would protect against that phenomena, which is how cyber attacks and physical sabotage would try to bring the grid down. So you're protecting against all those, plus hurricanes and tornadoes, because, you know, big protracted voltage blackouts are caused by these natural phenomena in a similar way. You know, they knock down high power lines, and the voltage in those lines has to go somewhere. It backs up into the transformers and burns them. But if you had surge arrestors and blocking devices, the transformers and control systems would be protected, and they would survive. You know, we've been protecting Department of Defense military systems since 1963 from EMP, but we never did it for our vital civilian critical infrastructures the way the Russians and Chinese have. And we can't afford this unilateral vulnerability anymore, especially since we also face a threat from the sun, which really has only more, even though we knew about the 1859 Carrington event, it took the EMP Commission. The EMP Commission said, you know, the threat is not just from nuclear weapons, but it's also from the sun. The commission is the one that broke that story, that made that discovery. And so now that's part of the mix of the president's EMP executive order to try to protect our nation. an executive order which unfortunately is being hamstrung and slow-rolled and sabotaged by the same people, well, by the same mindset, by the resistance, you know, within his own U.S. government.
Right.
Hey, that's just crazy and sad.
When we come back from our break, I'd like to talk a little bit about our satellite networks, what would happen to them, and what the consequences would be if they got knocked out by, say, just a solar event.
Okay, and if we're making a list, I also want to know what the motivation is for people, for the people that are blocking it. I mean, you know, what are they getting out of this? I guess I can feel everyone wondering. Maybe I don't think I'm the only one. It seems like a stupid thing to oppose because they're going to have to live here too. But stupid is as stupid does. I guess we learned that from Forrest Gump. Got to take a quick break. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. So, Dr. Pry, those people all have to live here when the lights go out. So, do they just think they're special? It's not going to affect them. It's not going to affect their family, their friends, their neighborhood. What? I mean, how do you turn a blind eye to this and block it?
Well, that simple question has a complicated answer, and I've written a whole book about it. let me try. I'll apologize in advance for being long-winded, okay?
Because yeah, we're good with it. We've got a whole afternoon.
Answer to your question. And let's answer the same phenomena that is in the process of stopping, thwarting, slow-rolling our protection against EMP is what has resulted in the failure of the government to protect us from the coronavirus. And, I'm going to make some predictions that there may be hearings, there should be, after the coronavirus crisis is all over, people are going to go back and say, why did the president have to intervene? How come there weren't masks? Why weren't there ventilators? Why weren't there pharmaceuticals? And there was also a lot of other much more sophisticated things that were supposed to be being done that were within the capability of the U.S. government to do that obviously haven't been done. An example of that, you know, is that we could use the supercomputers at the nuclear weapon labs to spend decades modeling the different permutations of viruses that could have come out of that we're worried about, you know, like swine flu and that kind of thing. Now, there's an infinite number of possibilities, okay, but the supercomputers can produce an almost infinite number of permutations. And then you could look at what are the most likely permutations and come up with hypothetical solutions that we could have and have that all in a file cabinet. Now, we probably wouldn't hit it right on the head and have been able to have something already packaged for the coronavirus, but we probably would have come very close so that it would drastically reduce the time that we would be able to. Now, why weren't we ready for all those things? The answer to that, there are several answers to that. The biggest one is just stupidity. You know, decades ago, we were told to get ready for biological warfare. All right, and the bureaucracy responsible for protecting the country wasn't used to protecting against biological warfare, and they would rather protect us by the ways that they are used to doing it, by having strong conventional forces, by having our nuclear deterrent. The money struggle, you know, to what programs get funded, you know, BW preparation would be way down low on the list, you know, because everybody else has higher priority than them. They don't have as much bureaucratic clout in the system. And there just aren't that many bureaucrats around who cared enough about it. You know, everybody wanted to protect their own rice bowl. So there was that economic kind of self-interest mitigating against our biological warfare preparedness. Then you would have the problem and this is not a small thing, but ideology. Like nuclear weapons, biological warfare is one of these politically incorrect threats that the left doesn't like to talk about. Their rationalization is that we are provoking, that we should set a good example for the world by not having biological warfare programs, which is why we signed on to the Biological and Chemical Weapons Convention. The bad guys will follow our example, which they did not. Russia, China, North Korea, all these bad guys have clandestine biological warfare programs, offensive biological warfare programs, and we do not have them anymore. But the left believes in arms control and believes that we are chiefly the provocateur, and we cause an action-reaction cycle when we have these programs. And so there's just tremendous ideological pressure, especially within the government bureaucracy, which is dominated by the left. You know, conservatives like to go in the private sector. They don't like to work in government. The left loves to work in government. It's their dream. You know, they believe the big government is the way of doing good. And so you have a preponderance of people in the left. And, by the way, the CDC and the NIH, I mean, if you look at what their political orientation is, who they give to in elections and all the rest, you know, they're a hotbed of liberal and left-wing radicalism in terms of who they support and what their ideological views are. And so there's just that internal ideological pressure. Now, I don't think that the biological warfare problem had the same problem that EMP did in terms of having an outside actor that, like the electric utilities, that didn't want to do anything. And so they had huge lobbying organizations to try to protect, to prevent legislation from being passed and the like. I don't think that pertained, but obviously it hasn't been necessary. It was just two of the factors. You know, basically, the bureaucratic, political, economic interests of the bureaucracy focusing on things other than biological warfare, and then the ideological bias against biological warfare because it's politically incorrect. I don't know if you're old enough, but perhaps you recall that during the Cold War, when the CDC and NIH did try to do their jobs and get hospitals to do exercises, biological warfare exercises and things of that sort, there was a great protest from the hospitals, and they wouldn't cooperate, and it caused a lot of bad publicity at the time, and embarrassing for the administration. I think it was maybe the Carter administration or something, and so they stopped doing that. But those two factors alone were sufficient to lead us to the place where we are today, where we're not protected. Oh yes, and then greed. Among the bureaucrats, you know, one of the things that, and that's not a small thing, when it comes to the lack of preparedness, the institutions that are responsible, or the bureaucracy, the parts of the bureaucracy that are responsible for the protection, will look like they're making progress by having studies and conferences, and maybe having exercises and war games. Okay. And hiring their Beltway Bandit friends to do the same. And those studies cost a lot of money. So do the exercises and the conferences. They cost a lot of money. And there was a more eloquent way of putting this. I was actually having a conversation at the dollar store with a checkout girl. Because she was asking me about this. How come we're not ready about the coronavirus? You know, and I mentioned to her, well, you know, it really is astonishing that we're not, because we've spent billions of dollars on decades getting ready. And what happened to all of that? And a gentleman, you know, a minority gentleman, he looked like he was a tradesman of some sort who's just leaving ahead of me on the line. He said, I'll tell you what happened. They put it in their pocket. And he's right. That's what happened. That's what happens with these studies and conferences and all the rest. It's their way of taking the money and putting it in their pocket. And what happened to the money that was supposed to be spent on biological warfare preparedness, and what's happening now with the EMP preparedness, because they're reinventing the wheel unnecessarily. We've already done the studies. You know, we've spent 50 years doing the studies. You know, we know what the threat is. We know how to protect against it. We don't need any more studies. You know, what we need is for these guys to get off their duffs and actually start doing the work, actually putting in surge arresters and blocking devices and Faraday cages. That's what they should be doing. It's been a year since the president's executive order, and they haven't done a single thing like that. It's all about studies and conferences and the same kind of thing they did with biological warfare. And what happened to all the money? Well, next time you're in the Washington, D.C. area, you know, go out to any of the big suburbs where the guys who work in the senior executive services live, and look at those mansions. You know, that's where the money went, and that's the problem. So that's a long-winded answer.
No,
to boil
that's
it
all
right. down, it's stupidity, lobbying, political bureaucratic self-interest and greed. Those four factors account, you know, for how what happens. The same people, you know, you said their children at risk too. Well, their children are at risk from the coronavirus too. But given the choice between defending against a hypothetical long-term threat and taking, you know, $1 million and putting it in your pocket right now, I can tell you what the typical Washington bureaucrat will do every time. And it will be to sacrifice the interests of the country for personal enrichment now.
Well, it's, you know, this virus, they were talking about the other day that they were warned several years ago that there's going to be a pandemic and our national reserves are not ready for it and we need to get ready for it, and they ignored it. In
well,
fact, they even sold off some of the...
1919.
Yeah.
We've known, the scientific community has known since 1919 that there could be another pandemic, and we were supposed to be getting ready for it. And that's when what's so astonishing to me and what has been an eye-opener to me, because as I said when I began this peroration, that I thought I knew the depths of Washington's incompetence and corruption. But even I have grossly underestimated how bad they are.
Yeah.
It's stunning. And just for people who listen to our show on a regular basis, you have you've heard about the SES employees, the Senior Executive Service, because we spoke about them a lot when we covered the VA. Those were the folks that we were highlighting in those programs. So the Senior Executive Service are in multiple places, not just there. But we have to take a really longer break, I guess. It's like what I tell the dog when I leave for work and he has to stay home. I tell him I'll be back in 5 seconds. So I guess I'll tell you we'll be back in 5 seconds right after the news. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us, and we have everything on there about the task force, how you can join it, and all that good stuff.